In a world of complex and overwhelming challenges, the Inspirational Insights podcast provides a shift in perspective. Dive into the minds of brilliant thinkers, creatives, and edge-riding leaders who have adapted their thinking and leadership practices to match today's perplexing challenges. Your host, Donna Jones, leads captivating conversations with trailblazers from diverse fields who have transcended tough and complex conditions to contribute to a healthier world. Can we collectively break old habits to reinvent the human work-earth relationship and support the vitality and diversity of all life? Harnessing agility, embracing possibilities. Welcome to the journey.
I'm excited today to have a familiar guest, Rod Collins, who's just about to release a book called Nobody is Smarter Than Everybody. This is a topic we've had lots of conversations about as organizations morph away from traditional structures and into more distributed and decentralized ways of working and decision-making. Rod, I wanted to have a chat with you about the premise of your book. How is it that you came to this conclusion, and explore some of the key concepts in your thinking? Look at the backstory behind this book.
The book was actually released February 20th. It's out there and available. Wow. Where does this all start? It starts in my junior year in college. I took a course in social psychology. I showed up for the class. There's 200 people in the room. And the professor announces right from the start, this is the only class you'll have to attend. He said, there'll only be two requirements for your grade for this course. It'll be a midterm and a final exam, all of which will cover material that is in your books. So if you want to just read the books and independently study, you could do that. The second half of your grade will be dependent upon your attendance at a simulated society weekend in October. He said, it's mandatory. If you miss it, you'll fail the course because 50% of your grade will be an F. And he said, if you've got a wedding to attend, drop the course. There'll be no exceptions. I thought, this is going to be interesting. There was a questionnaire that had to be filled out beforehand. Now, I remember one question very vividly, and it was this. Of the following three things, what motivates you the most? Affiliation, achievement, or power? Now, I went to college in the 70s. Power was not the politically correct answer. I knew affiliation and achievement would be more, but I knew the oddest answer was power. And so I checked it off. When it came time for the weekend, I told you there were 200 people in the class. The ideal size for the simulated society is 100 people. And so it was split into two. We were all assigned roles, and I was assigned the role of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for the society. And I had some intuition that checking power probably contributed to getting that role. There were rules in this session. We were split into four different rooms, and no more than 50% of the society could be in any room at one time. Different people had different levels of movement. Some could move freely, some had limited moves. So it was a society that had some stratification to it. Early in the simulated society, I was really stunned how people got into role. And there were people who were trying to abscond as much power as they could. I noticed that the president of the society and I had similar attitudes. Let's let the society grow as much as it can while respecting the individual freedom and movements of the people. If people could expand their wealth by contributing to society, we would support that. If they were doing it to serve their own needs, we would not. Over the course of the weekend, we were presented with many problems that needed to be solved and coordinated, and the difficulty when you can only have 50% in one area at one time. These were the challenges we dealt with, but we did. Periodically, you would measure the economic value of the society. Our economy was growing, okay? Nobody was dying, and you could die in this simulated society. By the time we got to the second day, the society was functioning so well that somebody came up with the idea, why don't we get everybody into two rooms on one side of the hall? It turned out that those two rooms had a portable partition, said, let's remove that and finish with a party. So as the Supreme Court justice and now Supreme Court decided there was nothing in the rules that prohibited it, the monitors went nuts. They said, you can't do that. And I said, there's nothing in the rules that says we can't. And they said, well, you suspend your judgment for 20 minutes so we can get the professor who's over with the other group. 15 minutes later, he comes in. He says, you'll be able to have your party after we have a half hour discussion on your experience here, because you've accomplished what less than 5% of societies do. You've accomplished a fully functioning society that works, and you've earned your party. And so for the next half hour, we reflected on that. That weekend influenced my whole attitude towards management through my professional life, because what I experienced was a dimension of power that is not as popular, and that is power with. When we think of power, most time it's power over, and individuals are trying to amass enough power for themselves over situations or over others. There are societies in which people are grabbing power so that they can hold that over others. I think as we look at the larger society today, power over is a big problem. Power with is a better form of power, and it leads to better social organizations. That affected my management practice. And constantly, when I was given positions of authority, always strove to set things up so that we would engage in power with rather than power over. And when you do that, you're more naturally going to leverage the collective intelligence of groups rather than to emphasize, amplify the intelligence of an elite few. That's the personal history. I've never been asked that question before, but I do tell that story in the book.
I'm so glad I asked. It's funny how one simple event early on in the career becomes defining in terms of your leadership and how you move through the world.
It's the most memorable experience of my college years.
I can imagine. I can see why as well.
Yeah.
All right. So when you look at the larger right now, it's a bit discouraging in terms of power over. As you said earlier, that dynamic is quite disturbing. And yet there's a certain population that is quite happy to be subservient to a authoritative power, one that has all the answers and can dispense it like a parent would in some cultures. What do you see is going on there that compels a bit of investment into becoming more sovereign with respect to ourselves as it moves into a collective intelligence environment, which is inevitable from a business point of view, but from a societal point of view, there's still lots of options.
Before commenting on the society, let me comment on the premise first, that there's a large number of people who will have authority and be told what to do. I think that's a reflection of a deeper need. And the deeper need is people have a need for order. I don't think people necessarily have a deep need for authority. If authority is the only way they'll get order, perhaps they'll go along with that. But order is the more important thing. The reason I say that is when I had the opportunity to bring this management approach into a real world organization, my experience was most people preferred the autonomy that this management model provided. And it was an autonomy in context of a better form of order. And so people were not clamoring for people to tell them what to do. They liked the level of order that this model produced. And that's why I realized, oh, it isn't authority they want, it's order. And the better the order, the more likely they are to remain. And in our particular division where we put this in place, our turnover rate was below 3%, which is remarkable. It was that way over a long period of time. It made me realize that people will work in a better ordered situation and turn down another job offer that would offer them more money. People want to be in circumstances where people know what the hell they're doing, and two, we get things done. And it's a very basic need. Those are the elements of order. We know what we're doing. We get things done. To answer the question as to what's going on today, I don't think there's much of a sense of we know what we're doing and we're getting things done. I think this is very interesting. And Google's been in the news. Google is perhaps an archetype for what could have been and what went wrong. Because when Google was born, it was probably the most brilliant company the world had ever seen. Google was, with its primary colors, was just this friendly place. There were even movies made about it. What Google was in its first decade was a prototype of what the digital revolution promised. Google is the first application to leverage collective intelligence to do its work. Its initial searches were remarkable. They were the last search engine in, but they grabbed the market quickly, and they've held on to it for all this time. For the first decade, they held on to it because they really did give us better results. What Sergey Brin and Larry Page did was leverage the collective intelligence of the users to rank the pages. They didn't put their thumb on the scale. They let the users, they let the collective intelligence of the users rank the pages. And it was an early demonstration of this principle: nobody is smarter than everybody. But something happened along the way. And I think somewhere around 2008, things really broke down. You had the introduction of Facebook, and its origins are dicey to begin with, especially if you saw the movie Social Media. I don't think that Facebook began with a model of don't be evil, as Google did. Facebook comes along, Twitter comes along, and the two of them begin to introduce the age of censorship. They take this new digital power and they turn it into a form of power over. Whereas when Google first starts, it's really a demonstration of power with and what that can produce. But unfortunately, Google has just gone in the opposite direction. And it's in the news these days because it's got to pull Gemini back, because Gemini is, quite frankly, reflecting the conscious or unconscious biases of a particular group of people who work there and are using their influence and authority to color what Google's producing. It's the exact opposite of collective intelligence. It's the imposition of a particular point of view upon a larger population. And I think Google needs to be careful, because great companies can fall. And if Google does not go back to its roots, we're likely to wake up one day and find it's gone. Because all we need for Google to go away is for somebody to invent a search engine, once again, that leverages collective intelligence, tackles the idea of a revenue model. Perhaps advertising is not the best revenue model, because one of the problems with advertisers is they can capture media. Capturing media exerts a tremendous power over. And so if somebody comes up with a better revenue model, not depending upon advertising, free to leverage the collective intelligence of its users, if they combine it, for example, with a form of cryptocurrency. Because another problem with Google today is it is a feudal society. We've returned to feudalism, because all of the value in Google is produced by the users. If there were no users, Google would be worth nothing. And yet none of us are compensated for the value that we add to Google. All the value goes to the employees and the shareholders. Hence, we have a form of digital feudalism. So somebody comes along, creates an equally valuable search. Actually, I think today you could create a better search, go back to Google's original model, pay people through cryptocurrency. They could put Google out of business in no time flat. And larger companies and more successful companies than Google have fallen by the wayside. Do we remember Kodak? And I think this is a cautionary tale. I think as we go forward, I do believe in the end that the earlier versions of the digital revolution will return, that we will once again leverage collective intelligence, that we will for the first time have artificial intelligence, because we don't have artificial intelligence today. What we have is artificial information. And we should not confuse information with intelligence. Information are points of view. Intelligence, true intelligence, is the bringing together of different perspectives and creating knowledge, where different points of view are welcomed and where they learn from each other. That is what artificial intelligence will be. So we've not seen it yet. But I think when we do see true AI, and there will be a true AI, it will return the digital revolution back to its first decades when it had so much hope. And I think this will also affect organizations. The top-down hierarchy, its days are past. It's an idea that's past because the world is just moving too fast. All of the rancor that we're seeing in society today, it's really the death knell of the hierarchy. They say when the sun dies, it just expands and it just gets very big before it goes away. I think we're seeing that now. The top-down hierarchical model is getting very big before it goes away.
The very thought that many people are using Gemini to write their books and so forth is quite frightening when you consider that worldview sitting behind it. I appreciate you covering that. That's very helpful. Yeah. And I think also what it marks is a shift in where we stand, being very clear about what you stand for versus not stand for. I think there's a has to be a fundamental anchor of who am I in relationship to this behind the scenes manipulated perception or manipulated worldview. It's always recognizing that, okay, this is what I'm seeing, but what's really behind it is something else. When you look at business, let's just look at that for a second.
Yeah.
What do you see? Because there's been a longstanding resistance toward distributing power. There's been a fear around losing power over others instead of recognizing that you gain power by being in control of yourself, you know, by bringing yourself into a higher level of self-awareness and therefore leadership. What do you see in that regard for the purposes of context? Rod was the former COO of in Blue Cross Blue Shield in the U.S. You know, you've seen firsthand how people can take that and turn it to their own ends.
Mm-hmm.
What is the biggest fear facing these individuals now, and what's the biggest opportunity that goes with it?
I think the biggest measurement indicator of the future of top-down hierarchical management structures is the Fortune 500 and the decreasing length of time in which companies are on that list. 40 years ago, you could be on that list for 40, 50 years. The command and control management model was solidified because if I could dominate the market through efficiencies, and anybody who comes along with incremental change, I can watch them experiment with it, perfect it, and then bring it into my model at a more cost-effective and a more product-effective or operationally effective way, I'm going to dominate the market. That's what companies in the 20th century did. And they stayed on the Fortune 500 list for decades. Now, companies are dropping off in less than a decade. And why are they dropping off? They stay as long as their product model is viable. The business of tomorrow has got to have the capacity to evolve from product model to product model. So let's take a very real example of two types of companies. One represents the past, the other represents the future. And the two of them almost intersected. And it's Blockbuster and Netflix. Blockbuster was the king of videos. They just dominated, I believe, all of North America. I know they dominated the United States. I suspect that they were in Canada as well. They were operationally efficient at providing VHS and beta tapes that you could rent. Somewhere in the 90s, the co-founders of this innovative company called Netflix knocked on the door of the CEO of Blockbuster and offered to sell themselves. They were $50 million in debt. They offered to sell themselves for $50 million to get out of the debt and said, we'll build Blockbuster.com. The CEO said, this digital stuff is just a fad. It'll never affect our business. And he turned them away. He was wrong. So here's the problem with top-down hierarchies. Single individuals can make unilateral decisions. This killed the company. On the day that Netflix offered itself to Blockbuster, Blockbuster was a $6 billion enterprise. It was on the verge of joining the Fortune 500, which it did, and it lasted all of 4 years before it dropped off and went bankrupt. The co-founders at Netflix were right. Today, they're a $300 billion operation. Blockbuster passed up a 50-fold growth opportunity because they couldn't evolve. What if they had said yes? They would have had a 10-year period in which they could have adapted their business models. Netflix did not make the mistake Blockbuster does. Netflix isn't sending DVDs to your home anymore. They don't even do what they first did. All right. They understood the importance of streaming. They got into movie production, and they will continue to evolve because they bring elements of this peer-to-peer network structure into their organization, and they are designed to change. One of the advantages networks have is anyone in a network structure can put together a team if they can get volunteers. There's nobody they have to get permission from. Eight people or so could get together and say, we're going to build something. And they can get together and say, we're going to build the product that's going to put our current product out of business. And they're free to do that. And they can work on that. They'll have to earn funding. Funding is not necessarily given, but anybody is free to pursue ideas. And when organizations are built like that, they manage their own evolution. Because every product model a business has is going to die, and somebody's going to put it out of business. Why not you? Unfortunately, the way things are happening now, and we don't notice it as consumers, companies that can't evolve, they die, and we don't even notice they're gone. Because the companies that take their place wow us with such value, we don't even notice that Radio Shack isn't around anymore, or that Blockbuster isn't here anymore. Nobody's pining for Kodak. We don't notice it because we're not missing them. But if companies want to stay on the Fortune 500, and I believe Netflix wants to stay on the list of the best companies, you have to have the capacity to evolve. Networks are the solution for management going forward.
I agree, because hierarchies in and of themselves are structured around control from the top to the bottom, and it's control over others all the way through, which is interesting, because this is where I think the bias of fearing loss steps in over realizing gain, even understanding that we have a natural human bias toward fearing loss. If you paid attention to that at all, then you would recognize that, okay, wait a minute, what am I doing here? I'm afraid of, if Kodak had done that, their decision would have been different, because they were afraid of losing their existing market share when they made that decision. Yeah. When you recognize that's what you're doing, is you're shutting down opportunity, and you're basically sticking to the program, regardless of how the context is changing.
Right. And to add insult to injury, Kodak invented the digital camera. Salespeople put it on the shelves and says, don't let anybody see that. We're in the business of film.
I can remember when I was writing a script, I think it was around 2008 or so, it was the film industry that came to the rescue of Kodak, because there were certain directors that did not want to use digital. They wanted to use the older format, and they basically rescued Kodak at the time. Our environment right now calls for a lot of adaptive thinking. I call it adaptive minds. That's my version of it. But it's very much around, how do we adapt ourselves to meet the challenges of today? Now, when we ask that question, what would you say succinctly for an executive team or anybody at any level, to be honest, because even small companies have got their own executive level decisions to be made. You don't have to be big to ask these kinds of questions, but you do need to be curious. What kind of questions would and should senior level folks or mid-level folks be asking to address these underlying changes?
I think the big question companies have got to ask is, and be honest about, do I have the capacity to innovate? Because if you can't innovate, you can't evolve. And if you're living in a rapidly changing world, then without the capacity to innovate, you will last only as long as your current product model. Business leaders need to take a good hard look at what kind of organization they want to build. The peer-to-peer network and the top-down hierarchy are not equal alternatives. The peer-to-peer network is superior. And here's why. An organizational model will have a fundamental design principle that informs how it answers two questions. Those two questions define your organization. The design principle of the top-down hierarchy is trust authority. The design principle of the peer-to-peer network is nobody is smarter than everybody. Now, as a side comment, It's interesting. Here in the United States, okay, the number one concern among the population is our open border. And it's reached a point where it's disturbing people. The second thing on the list is people don't trust their government at levels we've never seen before in the United States. I'd say this is really reflective of what's happening in the Western world. We are questioning the design principle of trust authority. We've just gone through a pandemic episode where the authorities misled us, misinformed us, and engaged in a level of censorship that none of us thought would be possible in a free society. And all of these have led to an erosion of authority. I think there's a silver lining in that, because if the general population is moving away from trust authority, then they're open for a better design principle for organizations they either work for or in which they live. I would offer that nobody is smarter than everybody is that better design principle. Now, how do these two models answer two basic questions of an organization? Those two questions are, who decides? How does power work? In a hierarchy, who decides? It's the elite few. And they tend to be experts. Experts are knowledgeable about the past. When the past is a proxy for the future, as it was in the 20th century, expertise works. But when the past is no longer a proxy for the future, you got trouble, because experts know about the past. But when the future is different, this is why innovation is so important. Experts are not necessarily good at creativity. What you need for creativity is bringing together different perspectives, sometimes apparently opposing perspectives, because they lead to breakthrough thinking. We combine A and B that we thought could never live together, but when we really thought about it, we identified this element C. You put A, B, and C together, and wow, there's a solution that everybody could live with. We've all had that experience. Nobody's an expert in that. That's why you need to tap into nobody smarter than everybody. So in a network, who decides? Everyone. There are no powerless people in networks. But you don't have two-thirds of your employees not engaged in their work like happens in hierarchies. Who are the two-thirds in hierarchies not engaged in their work? They're the two-thirds of people who don't have any power. People have a need for a certain amount of autonomy and power. It's a high need. Yeah. Everyone on the team helps to contribute to decisions. You get better decisions in teams because you correct for the unconscious biases that happen in top-down hierarchies. Because when you can't challenge the boss and the boss is acting out of an unconscious bias, you're stuck with that. But when you're in a team and you can challenge each other, then these unconscious biases can be surfaced, you can work them through, and then you can work to a more reasonable and more intelligent solution. The second attribute, the second question we've talked about already at the beginning of our discussion, how does power work? In hierarchies, power is a function of force. It's coercive power. It's legitimate coercive power. It is the ability to command people to do what they otherwise would not choose to do. In networks, power is a function of an entirely different attribute. Power is energy. It's not coercive power. It's synergistic power. It's not a priori power assigned to positions. It's power that emerges from the activity of the group and expands itself into the marketplace. That's why a company like Netflix grew to 50 times what Blockbuster was, because they're operating on some form of synergistic power. They're constantly in touch with their customers. They're not operating within four walls. Their world is not about what's my position in a company. Their world's about what's my position in a marketplace. What are new ways to create value? How do I stay connected with customers as things are changing? So having everyone involved in decision-making through teams and power being a function of synergy rather than coercion, and when your design principle is nobody's smarter than everybody, these are the ingredients that help a company to innovate. Those who can innovate can stay on the Fortune 500 for decades.
That makes perfect sense. By the way, I need to thank you for explaining why I get allergic to the word expert, because every time I hear somebody say you're an expert, I just go, I don't want to be one. That's not what I'm trying to be at all.
Experts are valuable because we need to bring information about the past into our discussion. It's just that can't be the exclusive information anymore. That's why we don't have artificial intelligence systems, because we're not creating knowledge, okay? We've got a bunch of self-appointed experts working for big tech firms who've decided they're smarter than everybody else, and they're going to impose their information on you. I'm certainly not going to call it their intelligence, because we're not getting intelligence in these, quote, AI systems. We're getting censoriously protected information. Any system that censors is not intelligent.
It's fearful.
By definition.
It's quite fearful. One of the artists on LinkedIn put out this lovely illustration, which I haven't yet used in my writing, although I received permission, but it was called the iceberg of ignorance. The top level is what the executive teams are working with, is the ignorant part, and because all the other information is resting in the bottom. And I think there's something telling about that. You can live in a reality, but it's a bubble of reality. You have to be self-secure and trusting enough to be curious and open up the walls and just say, tell me, help me understand this. You have to be able to ask those inquiry-based questions.
Yes.
So that you can bring in these diverse intelligences to bear on a particular question that the organization is asking, or that we need to face in the world as well. The other comment I'll make is when you mentioned about order.
Yeah.
Humans, I've noticed just walking around, humans are very uncomfortable with mess. And it's not that mess is good, but mess serves a purpose. The more we cut our lawns and manicure and trim or replace it with artificial, and then at the same time, we've got this insect crisis that comes from removal of exactly that kind of messy habitat. We're the architects of our own demise simply by not being able to decide or discern what's a mess from what's a creative space. And
this is a very important point. You remind me. One of the things I did when I was inside the Blue Cross Blue Shield organization, I led a business alliance of 39 separate companies, and that's a challenge, okay? We invented this process called a collective intelligence workshop, because we really believed nobody was smarter than everybody. So we get a microcosm of the business in the room in the presence of about 50 people. We would mix levels and departments, and we invited all points of view. Whether we agreed with them or not didn't matter. We needed all points of view in there, because you need that for the ingredients of creativity. When we would do these sessions, they were usually about 2 days, but somewhere towards the latter part of the morning, we really unearth a lot of things, because in a network, there's no unacceptable information. We're bringing everything out, and you could feel a level of uncomfortability in the room. And as the facilitator of the process, I could look over the room and say, is everybody completely overwhelmed right now? Do you feel like this is far worse a problem than we thought, now that we've dug into this, and you can't see any way out of it, and you're experiencing a tremendous sense of chaos? And I would see all the nodding heads in the room, and I would say, good, we're exactly where we need to be. Because in every project, there are two phases. Our only choice is the order. The phases are chaos and order. Why do traditional organizations get it backwards? They go to premature order, they wind up with chaos. I said, we are experiencing the chaos first, and from that will come the order. And I would generally call about a 30-minute break, because you could really feel the despair in the room. Inevitably, after that break, as I'd start up, somebody would say, I was thinking about this, and would begin a discussion, all right? And all of a sudden, and this is the importance, there were no experts. This person's making this observation. Another person's making another one. Someone says, let's combine this. Let's bring in this. This is why the microcosm in the room, the network is in the room. And all of a sudden, we hit the solution. When we hit the solution, people realize this is going to work. And as much despair as they experienced before the break, was the absolute joy they had when they realized, we have licked this problem and it's going to work. Remember, people have this need to be with people who know what they're doing. And when we do things together, they work. That's what would come out of the collective intelligence workshop. Everyone left the room saying, I just spent time with people who know what the hell they're doing, and what we've come up with is going to work. And the beauty of it was it transferred immediately to people who weren't in the room.
I think the beauty of diversity of perspective, of thinking, is that there's a place where it's just pure acceptance.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree, but you do have to be able to entertain. I think there's another principle that runs out there that says something like strong positions loosely held. It always allows for an opening that you hadn't considered. In the same categories, don't believe everything you think. There's a number of places where you could do a little check stop in your head when you're in the moment and go, wait a minute, am I fully believing everything I'm thinking? Because if so, I'm blind to opportunity at the moment. I'm blind to insight. I'm blind to seeing what's coming down the road. That's the other thing I appreciate about what you were saying about chaos and order. Chaotic environments have order.
Yes.
It's implicit, it's subterranean, but it's there. This is where emergence comes from. It's just more a matter of being patient. And that takes a level of trusting yourself more than anything else. It's not about trusting others until you trust yourself. You have to be able to hold that spot and hold that space and then see what shows up and work with that. And I think that's a major leadership opportunity.
Build on what you just said, one of the big differences between hierarchies and networks is the context in which they approach strategy. In the hierarchy, strategy is central planning. In the network, strategy is iterative discovery. It's not a planning process, it's a discovery process. And what's the difference? This item you mentioned, emergence. You can't innovate without emergence. You can't be creative without emergence. You can't innovate if you don't welcome all opinions, whether you agree with them or not. One of the important disciplines we had in the collective intelligence workshop I was telling you about is in the first hours of the workshop, certain people will make presentations because we'll bring in experts, we'll bring in people who are responsible for problems, and they set the stage laying out what the issue is and initially how they see it. People are restricted to clarifying questions only. They can't agree. They can't disagree. They can't say, I've got a better idea. The reason we did that is there's very little understanding that goes on in hierarchies. We don't listen for understanding. We listen to debate. There's very little understanding going on in the Western world today. Clarifying questions is, I'm going to understand what you are saying, regardless of my agreement or disagreement. It doesn't mean that we won't get to discussions later on, which we did do in these collective intelligence workshops. But once people understood each other, it's a way to get past the unconscious biases. It's a way to say, oh, I thought you meant this, but you mean something different when I ask the clarifying questions. What tended to happen is once the information was out, once we had the period of clarifying questions and we began to move on to the work of integrating information, I noticed the quality of discussion shifted from the usual debate that you see around a conference room table where people say, no, that's not right, or I don't agree with this, or that's a dumb idea. What we were hearing in the collective intelligence workshops is, that idea there, let me build on that. Then somebody else says, oh, good, now that we got these two things, let me build on that. If you're going to innovate, your basic dialogue has got to be based on understanding, and it's got to be based upon people building on each other's ideas. You want people leaving the room with the sense, what we did here today is something that no one of us could have ever come up with by ourselves. You can't get that sense in an environment that is defined by censorship. Just can't happen. No. Censorship is the greatest danger facing most corporations today because it's going to kill their ability to innovate and think. Censorship is the pathway to ignorance.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
Respect for all different points of view doesn't mean you have to agree with them, okay? But you have to respect them. Where you tend to land is we'll have solutions of common ground and we'll pursue those together while maintaining our differences in other spaces. That's how regular societies normally work. I saw it happen in business with great success. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that, Rod. I really do. What would you see as advice or as a heads up for the executive tier in traditionally run organizations that are really struggling with the idea, for example, that if I just hang on until I can leave, or if I can just hang on and get my whatever, my pension, whatever the rewards are for hanging on, what would you say to them? Because there's a number of companies where you've got a young cadre of people coming up. They're either wondering what the heck is going on because their expression is being suppressed under the existing system. They don't have a voice. They put forward great creative suggestions and they get shut down. Or someone decided to sing the same hymn book and hope it gets them through. What kind of advice would you give to that, the blockers, the ones that are afraid to let go and to trust themselves in their capacity to adapt going forward?
For those who are in established organizations, look for opportunities where you can design your work processes as networks rather than hierarchies, where you can set up cross-functional teams, do that, where those teams can share decision-making authority, do that. Don't put somebody in charge of the team. Let the team self-manage itself. It'll be challenging because there's a long history in hierarchies. I really would be more interested in directing the advice to people who are starting companies, startups, because they are on the front edge of innovation, and to advise them on how they can maintain that decade after decade, especially if they're interested in building a company and not working towards an exit event, right? When your company, if it's successful, begins to approach 50 people, you're going to feel the need for a formal organization. I always say the management model of the typical startup is the dysfunctional family. And I'm not being pejorative in saying that. Most of us were raised in them, and thank God, because we develop coping skills that have served us as adults. The worst thing you can do to a kid is put him in a perfect family. They don't learn coping skills, and they're handicapped when they get into the real world. As you hit 50 people, you're going to need to organize. Don't build the top-down hierarchy. That is the moment in which you can build a peer-to-peer network. Organize around teams. And keep in mind two important numbers. This is what Bill Gore, the founder of Gore and Associates, has been using this management model for since the 1950s. Today, they're an 11,000-person company in the world, and they still have no bosses. Teams should be 7 to 12 people. Keep in mind the number of 150. Because Bill Gore, when he put this model in, saw it work well until they hit about 150 people. When they hit 200 people, it really was getting chaotic. Rather than build a hierarchy, he split them into two autonomous groups. Gore and Associates is this collection of business units. There are approximately 150 people each. They're all autonomous. And that's what you need to do. That's what the network structure looks like. They have processes where people from different units can come together, so they're cross-pollinating information. And that's the purpose for doing that. Resist the hierarchy, build a network. If you want an example of companies that do it well, W.L. Gore and Associates, the makers of Gore-Tex, Morningstar, the world's largest tomato processor that started as a startup. They're out in California. For those who are in our European audience, Bertzorg in Holland employs 70% of home healthcare nurses because they know working in networks is better. That happened organically. That would be my advice.
Beautiful advice. Thank you. From my point of view, I would love to see people trust themselves more and grow into the challenge as opposed to run from it, because I think we've got a lot of opportunity to bring out a higher level of leadership, and not a higher level in the terms of boss to subservient or that kind of relationship, but more going back to the collective, yeah. Collective action, shared goal, all of the things that we know make networks work.
Yeah.
Rod, your book is out. Where do we go? Is it the usual places?
You can find it on Amazon. It's available now, and I put it in three versions. You can get it as Kindle, a hardback, or a paperback, whatever pleases you. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thanks very much for being on the program today. I always enjoy our conversations. Thank you for joining me.
The use of power is multiple levels. It's personal, it's organizational, and of course, nowhere do we see it more exemplified than with government decisions. So this is an opportunity to rethink use of power, personal power, how we manage ourselves in organizations, to be aware of the use of power. We need to be consciously aware of what impact we are having. And that simply means interrupting oneself and observing, what kind of impact will I have if I do this or if I do that? What will change as a result of the actions I take. Questions that can be difficult to ask oneself, but they're the ones that open the door to see what lies ahead. It's part of the muscle of developing foresight. In the wider scheme of things, we're replacing force with cooperation, with coordination, and with collaboration. These are skills that require higher trust than telling people what to do. When there's a high level of insecurity in an organization, it's easy to observe that people get more desperate hanging on to control versus working with a releasing of control and regaining it within oneself, which is obviously a much more peaceful way of navigating the world. I'd like to say it's a perfect practice, but it's not. And that's part of the beauty of it. It sometimes you're aware of what happens after the fact. I've certainly had that happen to me where I've realized I've said something, it's come out of my mouth, and then I thought, oh my gosh, what did I just do to that person? Did I leave them feeling better about themselves or worse? That's my opportunity to correct how I frame things and how I say things. So it starts within. I hope you've enjoyed this program. This is all part of a wider series that applies both to personal leadership and organization transformation. As organizations figure out that they are here to evolve and adapt and to serve an incredibly important purpose in the world right now, which is to restore the vitality to social, ecological systems, and also workplace conditions. Comment or share this program with others.